Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Some observers of higher education have said that Tufts University went out on a limb when it chose Dr. Anthony Monaco to serve as the university's newest president. Monaco doesn't have the typical track record of a university administrator. He's a scientist, a brilliant one, who made pioneering discoveries in human genetics. He's also spent many years in England as a researcher and vice chancellor at Oxford University, as evidenced by a statue of Jumbo, the Tufts elephant, that sits on his desk. This Jumbo is wrapped in the colors of the British flag. But perhaps it is this global and scientific background that drives Monaco's impressive new vision for Tufts. He wants to transform the already highly ranked university into an interdisciplinary powerhouse that tackles world problems via projects that cross campuses, departments, and majors. And that interdisciplinary approach? Well, it's a recurring pattern in Monaco's own life, as I discovered when I recently visited his office. You'll hear more about his life in just a moment, but first, I want to share Anthony Monaco's response to the question that's on everybody's mind right now. Why does college cost so much?
Well, higher education is very costly to run because it's not like making a car where you can try to be more efficient at it by an assembly line process. It's a personal service provider in a sense that you're not trying to become more efficient by packing more students into the classroom. So I think we have to first realize that it, on the macroeconomic view, it's a sector which, like dentistry or medicine, is traditionally going to be above the rate of inflation in its cost increases because of the way it's delivering. It also requires a lot of investment in facilities and in business systems to run all the programs. And we need highly trained individuals, not only on the faculty, but also in the administration to do that. The same time, we have we've just finished a condition survey of all of our buildings on all three campuses to show we have a backlog of deferred maintenance that we can't let go. Otherwise, future generations will be paying twice over for this. So we have to think about investing money into our buildings to make sure that they're not falling apart. We have to invest money in our systems. Otherwise, they will break down and we won't have a university that functions. These are all costly, and I think those are some of the main reasons why you see the cost of higher education as high as it is today.
I guess the concern is that over time, the percentage of students who get some financial aid but have to take mostly loans has just been growing because of the increase in cost of education. And now there's this creeping concern that the lifetime cost of that debt, it's a challenge to the value of their education, because they wonder, like, I can't get a job that helps me pay off this debt, whereas that was what I was supposed to have when I graduated from college.
Well, I think you also have to look at, there's universities and there's universities. I mean, Tufts is a very selective university, and I think the value of the education here is worthy of our students and the employment prospects they will have. One of my other concerns about the indebtedness of students, it will push them into careers that may not be the best thing for society to have so many people in those careers, and the reason they may do that is because of their concerns of paying off loans. So, you know, we need more individuals involved in community engagement, public service, teachers. I'm not saying people in finance aren't good for society, but I just worry, as you do, about large percentages of our graduates going to that sector, regardless of what they were studying at university.
Now, I've got to jump out of the interview here for just a moment and say Anthony Monaco is the first university president I've spoken to who said this, that he's worried about the long-term societal effects of debt-loaded students seeking out high-paying banking jobs. And the data do exist to justify Monaco's concern. A recent Harvard Magazine study found that among Harvard's class of 2011, 41% plan to get a job in financial services, consulting, or sales and marketing, regardless of what they studied in college.
I think the trend is also true of our professional schools. I have some concerns that the indebtedness of medical students is pushing people to subspecialties rather than general practice and non-lucrative parts of medicine like pediatrics, where we need lots of good quality doctors.
Let me just interject. I'm sorry to interject, but even in the sciences, because a scientist right now doesn't get paid as much as someone who's a starting financier.
Most people that go into science don't do it for the money.
Although Monaco is quick to add that particularly in Massachusetts, with our large science and biotech sectors, there are great employment opportunities. But this thing about doing science for the sheer love of it, Monaco is speaking from experience and from the heart, because that's exactly what he did as one of the first members of his family to go to college.
Yes, grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, three brothers and sisters. My father was a plumber. My mother worked in Sears and later in banking. Neither of them had a chance to go to college or university. I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to go to a private university, Princeton, and it was really because of very generous financial aid. I got interested in neuroscience while I was there and then off to Harvard Medical School.
Mm. Tell me more about your parents. What was your father's name?
My father's name is Francis, or Frank.
Tell me more about
that. So we're there. All my grandparents were born in Italy. So my parents were first generation in the U.S. They met. My father was in the Army and then got training as a plumber. And he was in the unions and, of course, had struggles in the 1970s during the Great Recession then, when construction came to a halt and was out of work and really couldn't cross, you know, into other avenues because of the union rules. So that put us on a lot of pressure when I was in high school. But in the same respect, it gave me the opportunity because we looked fairly low income at that time, and it gave me a financial aid package that allowed me to break out of the mold of going to the local state university and get on to Princeton, which was really fantastic.
So you went to Princeton and then Harvard for your MD, PhD.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about why you loved research so much.
Well, I think it was not only just research. I became very interested in neuroscience. I took some courses in as an undergraduate on the brain and behavior, and I realized this was an area that was going to really explode in the next, you know, couple decades because the knowledge base was good, but we had so much we didn't understand, and it was only going to be discovered through research. So I just got into the lab and started doing work and really, really enjoyed it. But I wanted to keep my ties to biology, so I actually created at Princeton, you could create your own major. It's called an independent concentration. And I did that in neuroscience and behavior. So I had courses in the psychology department as well as the biology department and advisors in both. But most of the research I did in the psychology department.
That must have seemed pretty revolutionary back then, whereas now the idea that brain and behavior are closely linked is sort of standard in terms of neuroscience research.
Yes, and now there's many majors in biopsychology or neuroscience, whichever you choose to call it. The interesting thing about that is that my biology advisor said to me, I really think you should take a course in genetics. Mm-hmm. And of course, me being me, I said, why would I need genetics? I'm interested in neuroscience. So little did I know that I would spend the rest of my career in human genetics. I think he was quite a wise advisor.
Now, was it in your, when you were writing your PhD dissertation that you made the discovery of is the FOXP2 gene?
No, that was later with
that
my own
later.
Lab.
Okay.
I worked on the identification of the gene for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It was one of the first genes identified for a human inherited disorder, so quite a landmark discovery, and it just exploded the amount of information that you could find out about how the muscle was organized, the muscle membrane, and all the other proteins that are associated. It began with that discovery. But at that point, I decided that I really wanted to pursue biomedical research as a career, and I felt I would have missed out on some of the early work that was going on in the Human Genome Project. So I wanted to go to London to work with Hans Lirach, who was an Austrian scientist who has just moved to London. I was only supposed to go for 2 years, and then I ended up spending the next 23 years in England.
At Oxford.
Yes, yeah, so they offered me a job, and I said, I'll take the job, but can I take it in Oxford? Because the cancer research fund that I worked for at that time was just setting up a floor in an Institute of Molecular Medicine in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was a great opportunity to get out of London and go to a very nice, big, world-renowned university and set up my lab in that kind of environment.
So there you are at Oxford, which, if you look over the entire history of modern science, is sort of the epicenter of multiple revolutions. And you had your own lab.
Yeah, so that's where I started my own lab, yep. In 1995, a bunch of us got together and founded a new institute with funding from the Wellcome Trust. And the idea was that we had made great progress in identifying genes for single gene disorders, like muscular dystrophy or cystic fibrosis or things like that. But could we use that knowledge and the knowledge of the Human Genome Project to approach more common disorders mm-hmm. like cancer, cardiovascular disease, asthma, frequent and common disorders in society? And we decided to use a very multidisciplinary approach. So we brought in mathematicians and statisticians, structural biologists and physicists, and of course geneticists and cell and molecular biologists all together in one institute.
Oh, so very interdisciplinary then.
Yes. I was interested in neurodevelopmental disorders, so I had a program on autism, dyslexia or reading disorders, and language impairments. And it was through that that we identified the gene FOXP2, which was the first gene seen to be involved in human speech and language.
So I asked you about that moment in particular because, I mean, I come from a family of scientists, and the way they talk about moments in great science, just getting there, it takes your entire being. The flip side of that is that there's no greater thrill than that. So I wonder, I mean, you're now in a world where you're not going to be doing any direct research. Are you going to miss that?
I will have to live vicariously off the research of others. I get a lot of positive rewards out of trying to push an institution to greater achievements. I have a great understanding of what it takes to do interdisciplinary research. And so one of the challenges, for example, here at Tufts is we have very strong foundations in our disciplines. So the problem, I think, here and at many other institutions is that things are organized in a very traditional department mm-hmm. and school basis.
The silos, essentially.
Yes, and I wouldn't say there are silos in the sense that people don't speak to each other. That's just the way it's organized. But if you look at the great world challenges facing society at the moment, things like obesity or cancer or environmental issues or issues that related to the emergence of new democracies and conflict, a lot of the solutions to them are only going to go so far within individual disciplines. It really does require bringing people from other disciplines to different perspectives, new innovative ways of thinking, implementation plans for solutions that require cross-disciplinary collaboration. And so what you're trying to layer on top of this traditional, if you want to call it siloed organization, is a matrix where you can try to get the flow of faculty and students across disciplines to come up with that impact that Tufts should have going forward. So that to me is a challenge that I would like to work with my colleagues here in the community and see if we can produce something that is much, much greater than the individual parts. And I think we can do that here at Tufts.
So the major problems, the major global challenges that you've been speaking about have something of a science and medicine biotechnical tilt.
Some of
to them,
yeah.
I mean, I wonder how, how does a humanities education, which is also a major part of what's provided here at Tufts, how does that figure into it?
Well, we've put that challenge to the humanities and social sciences faculty. So we've asked them, could they please go away and think of the themes they feel we should focus on? So they've come up with ideas about language and cognition, globalization, issues related to race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation in multicultural studies. So there's plenty of topics that they're passionate about that I think that would be amenable to this type of process.
What is your, as president, greatest challenge, you think, in making that vision a reality?
Well, I think one is to convince people to do the work, to make recommendations that we can think about funding, but we've got to also come up with opportunities for funding, whether that's school budgets, central funding, leveraging external funding. I would like to make us more competitive by this exercise to get external foundation and government funding for our research.
So for listeners out there who are parents or who may be undergraduates themselves, how does your vision affect what is the educational mission here at Tufts?
Well, I think in some ways the educational mission has gone forward before I ever arrived. I mean, many undergraduates here at Tufts are taking an interdisciplinary major or minor. We have international relations, which is 40% of our undergraduates are studying international relations. And that is not a department. That is something that they have to pick and choose courses from different departments. We're now creating a new curriculum based on race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and multicultural. This was pushed in large part by the students, but also the faculty, and that'll be another interdisciplinary program. So I think the students want to come to Tufts because they are given the flexibility to think innovatively and creatively about what they decide to study. And I think what we're doing now on the research side in the graduate education will hopefully reinforce what they've been doing here for some time.
It suddenly occurs to me it's also what you did for your own education at Princeton.
Yes.
There's a pattern
yes,
here.
There's a...
Well, President Anthony Monaco, thank you so much for your time and thank you for speaking with me.
It was very nice to meet you. Thank you.
Anthony Monaco completes his first year as president of Tufts University at the end of this academic year. We spoke with him at his office on campus in Medford.
And stay with us. Coming up, Hillary Hughes has our weekend picks that have a bit of a Valentine's Day flavor. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.